This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat with actress, artist, and collector CCH Pounder. We'll discuss her personal collection, which is part of the Prospect 4 art installation. Then we'll share another episode of The Listening Post, asking our neighbors about community policing. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. But first, here's one of NOLA Life stories. The civil rights movement witnessed students becoming teachers as they propelled social change. New Orleanian and lifelong activist Raphael Casimir was a student leader who eventually became a professor of history. In this edition of NOLA Life Stories, Dr. Casimir chronicles his experiences as the local chapter president of the NAACP Youth Council.
I became aware of the difference between blacks and whites because we went to different schools, and also because of the segregated seating on the buses. The fact that there were screens on the buses and blacks sat behind them, whites sat in front of them. One of the things that I remember, I don't think I was as conscious as I would become later, it was something that bothered me. And I used to turn the screen around so that I didn't have to read it. And I think that was my first little civil rights protest. And I remember I was either 13 or 14 years old. I was riding the bus, and I turned the screen around. But by chance, two white policemen got on the bus. They were looking for somebody. They passed me up, and they went to the back. They were looking for somebody, and they got the guy off the bus. And then people asked me to say, well, what would you have done if the police had told you to turn around? I would like to believe that I would not have, I don't know. Police had a bad reputation then. But in my mind, that was my first little civil rights victory.
I got something in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing.
We got involved in the first voter registration campaign. It was in the Desire Project in 1960. Teaching people how to fill out the form. That was a test. I mean, people really wanted to register to vote. Unlike my grandmother, who was literate, and I mentioned her father and her grandfather had been registered, who wanted to vote but couldn't. I mean, one of the trick questions was to calculate your age to the day. And if you were off one day, you failed. I am now 75 years, 4 months, and 13 days. Or what is the size in square miles of the District of Columbia? It's in the Constitution, 10 square miles, I knew that. And would go down and they'd say, well, you failed, you can't come back for 30 days. And that was frustrating. So the proof of the pudding is when the federal government filed a lawsuit against the Register of Voters in Plaquemine Parish, she flunked her own test.
To the public. If he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if in short he cannot enjoy the full and free life.
I missed the March on Washington. I was supposed to go to March on Washington, but because we were picketing, I didn't get to go.
We will march in Washington on August 28, 1963, along with hundreds of thousands of our fellow Americans who believe in equal opportunity and freedom for us all.
But over 2 years, we were able to gain literally hundreds of jobs, and it did, in fact, desegregate the cafeterias and the lunch counters.
And the Attorney General have encouraged demonstrations.
Students are important to all movements. If you think about it, and again, I had this romantic notion that we were in a revolution. You think back to most of the revolutions, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the revolutions in Latin America, it's mostly student-led. When you're 20, you're not afraid of anything. I wouldn't dream about doing some of the things today that I did then. But you don't fear death when you're young, at least then.
Come on, y'all.
Sing a song full of the faith that the darkness has gone.
But when we got to the National Convention, they knew about what was happening in New Orleans. And we say, okay, boy, news travels. And they said, keep up the pressure. And as I mentioned, I met somebody like Jackie Robinson. He was saying, you know, I know what's happening in New Orleans. And you're doing a good job. And Thurgood Marshall came down one year. Laurie Wilkins. You know, you had a sense that you were part of something much bigger than yourself.
This NOLA Life Stories interview was conducted by Mark Cave for the Historic New Orleans Collection and produced for WWNO by Sarah Holtz.
Good morning or evening, friend.
As part of the 2017-2018 Prospect New Orleans International Art Exhibition, Xavier University of Louisiana is hosting Queen, an exhibit featuring works from the collection of award-winning actress, artist, and collector CCH Pounder. And she joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So someone told me you only act so you can buy art.
It's not a lie. Years ago, I was married for about 27 years to my husband, Boubacar Kone. We had the first independent contemporary gallery and museum in Dakar, Senegal. And I was the procurer. So because it was private and it was just him and I, we had this marvelous journey to do.
Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask, you know, when you began collecting, but this isn't anything new for you.
No, not at all. I think even before Boubacar, I was collecting works from the Spiral Gallery in Brooklyn, New York. I was following my sister, who at that time was friends with James Denmark and Louis Del Sartre. She knew Ernest Krishlow, who lived across the street. And so when she would pick up a print, then she would always say, you need to go and buy a piece of this man's art. So even then, there was something. My father had a collection of African sculptures, ebony sculptures from Kenya. Mm-hmm. And I used to use one of them as my lucky charm when I'd go into auditions. So all along, I've had a connection.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned what your father collected, but is there a particular theme that you look for in your collection?
Well, my husband used to complain heavily that every painting you bring in here, there's a woman in it. And so I happen to have a really large collection of the female image, and particularly the black female image, and small, short, tall, huge, round, corpulent, mm-hmm. zoftig, thin, you know, the whole gamut of female pulchritude, as one would say.
Yeah.
And I didn't really notice that, but I am attracted to that. And it just happens to have come in wonderfully for this production of Queen.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. That's exactly what's being portrayed in Queen, and that's being viewed right now at Xavier University. Tell us about that collection.
This collection, Sarah Clunas, who's the head of the art history department and runs the gallery as well, along with Ron Beche, they came to me for a completely different idea. And when they saw the collection, they said, you know, we want to do something for Prospect. They're part of the satellite version of Prospect 4. And they had this idea of portraying the black female. And they felt in their university that they probably didn't have enough images for their students who happened to be predominantly female. Mm-hmm. And they really wanted to honor that. And when they saw my collection, they were like, well, we can actually, you know, delve and plow through the entire show from this collection.
As I was walking through the exhibit, admiring your collection, I couldn't help but notice a few pieces by you. Let's talk about Hair Chair.
Well, I've got a huge fascination for chairs, for seats of power, for seats of loneliness. So sort mm-hmm. of chairs and stools and thrones and so on. So I've had that for a really long time. I've been collecting tiny little chairs and or picking up thrown out chairs at the garbage and taking them home and turning them into pieces of art. Mm-hmm. And so in the show, there's the hair chair, which there's two versions of it. And the version of it I have there is about natural hair, my hair in particular, of all the different shapes, forms, lengths mm-hmm. that it's had, but it has never really had much chemical to it. And so it's been in a natural state on and off for almost all my life. I grew up in a convent. They did not know how to comb my hair, so they shaved it down. So I had really short hair at one point. And then when I sort of came into my young womanhood, the 70s were in full swing and a big afro was perfect. And I have had that then and I have that now. So, and in between, they're all kinds of, because I'm an actress, they're all, an endless manner of hairstyles that I've gone through. So I wanted to portray the fact that as Black women, we are an incredible source for economy in terms of hair, the amount we put on our heads, how much we spend in the salon. And that's what the pictures portray. And you'll see women from about 10 years old to, I think the oldest woman was 89.
Okay.
And they had all had a particular idea of what their hair should look like. And I think it really went to the age. So they were age specific. And at 89 years old, an afro was probably a horrific thing for a person who had spent her whole life trying to get it straight, trying to get it to conform to abnormality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's also another chair featured in the exhibit. Can we talk about that briefly?
Yes, that's also a found chair, but I have a collection of Dutch wax. And this particular piece, I knew it was going to be a chair. I just didn't know how until I found a discarded chair in one of the back alleys of one of my friend's houses. And I was like, ah, there it is. It's a wrought iron chair covered in roses. And I took, it's a portrait of a woman in Dutch wax, which is, of course, the most popular material in Africa. And underneath the chair, it's stuffed with dried roses. And it's kind of an homage to the real people that run Africa, which they're women. And I put dried roses under there because they're so rarely honored. And they're so rarely noticed that I couldn't even bring myself to constantly put a supply of living roses, which is what they really are. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to put the dried roses as a comment on their lack of notice, appreciation. They were the roses gone by, as opposed to realizing that they're actually here. And most of the time in Africa, women are mourned for the marvelous things that they did when they're dead, which is endless. Wangari Maathai, I can just name thousands of them who did marvelous things for their countries and were only appreciated after they were gone. So thus the dried roses.
Okay, now let's take a minute to talk about this. Your most recent role right now is on NCIS New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You play the role of Dr. Loretta Wade. And you spent a lot of time in the city, and now a little birdie told me you bought a house here.
You know what? We spend 10 months out of the year here.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much a short year in anybody's book. And after 4 years, you have to kind of make a decision that the show will run its course, which is probably a 7-year show. And the going back and forth to Los Angeles very much changed for me. Last year, I lost my husband. And so I sold that house. And I said, you know, ironically, this show and this town has given me an opportunity to start anew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very quietly, everything that I think I wouldn't like, swampy, damp, wet, moldy, bad streets, you know, super rich food, possibility of gout, all these things, endless parades, more parades than they are days, instead of this sort of heavy, entertaining town.
Yeah.
Which I have to say, from girl who raised in a convent, was a little difficult to get accustomed to, but it seems to have managed to take it over, like really warm socks sliding up your legs. And I ended up earlier on this year buying a house here, and I'm fixing it up. And there's another thing, is it's an old house. So I said to myself that the way for me to heal is to buy something old and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so as opposed to a process of mourning my husband's loss, he was a fantastic person in life. And I just didn't want to indulge in the missing and all of that. And I just said, just find yourself a house. And it will be an art house, of course, but fix it and you'll fix yourself. So this is my personal therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Art therapy works for everybody, I think.
And the city kind of gravitates toward you when it comes down to healing.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so.
In the weirdest way.
In the weirdest of ways. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, it can go either way. Mm-hmm. You can come here and drown yourself or you can swim.
Yeah.
Swimming.
You're swimming. Yeah. You're swimming. That was CCH Pounder, actress, artist, and collector. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Queen is an exhibition from the collection of CCH Pounder, on view right now at Xavier University. The Listening Post is a community engagement project that creates a conversation around local news. This month, The Listening Post wants to hear your ideas about community policing.
Welcome to The Listening Post. I'm your host, Thomas Walsh.
I think police officers are made to be desensitized so that when they enforce the law, they're able to do it without any emotional or humane logic.
That's a member of the New Orleans community whose experience with the NOPD has inspired this month's look at community policing. Joining me to talk about our latest survey results are producers Claudia Lopez and Natalie Yar. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
So shall we get right into things? We've got a lot of ground to cover. What did we ask people this month?
This month we really wanted to ask people about interactions that they've had with NOPD, strategies that they think community policing could implement, and also what they think NOPD could specifically do to improve their relationship with the community.
So what were some of the favorite results that stood out for you guys?
People were trying to get at the idea of being able to interact with the NOPD at other moments than a crisis. So when we have someone saying police walking the beat in neighborhoods, or we have another person that says community members should have a chance to approach officers, them coming into the neighborhood never feels right. Let us go to their houses.
Natalie, what stood out to you?
I texted back some of these people to ask them for a little bit more information. One person wrote saying that they were concerned about the training and the way that police were reacting. They felt like not every encounter should feel like a life or death, guns drawn situation. And they really wanted to see more programs available to make things go better in general. And they didn't feel like that the officers really saw this problem.
We saw a wide range of answers, both from I have this specific problem in my neighborhood that I would like to see resolved. Shout out to the 7th District, who has really bad response times, to theoretical issues about deep-seated relationships with the police. But Natalie, you had a chance to not only respond to these surveys, you went out and spoke with some of our survey participants.
Yeah, I got a message from someone who said that their big concern was what was NOP doing to serve Spanish speakers in New Orleans. She brought her coworker and friend with her. So I sat down with Elizabeth and Fernando to talk about their experience.
Community policing is kind of the opposite of how you see police, right? You see them as a response to bad things, not always a prevention. And so I think it is kind of a radical thing for New Orleans, especially when we have high crime rates and we have a lot of things that need immediate responses. They need that reactive. Where's the time for the proactive?
I also took this survey to the polls. I heard a lot of responses that we have actually already heard, mainly a lot of people wanting to see police walk the beat. But also a very strong interest was that a lot of people wanted to see community meetings that actually already exist in town. We actually all had a chance to attend a couple of these meetings, and I thought we might share what our experience was like going to the PCAB meetings, the Police Community Advisory Board.
So these PCAB meetings are a citizen board and one representative from the police may be in attendance. And this is organized through the mayor's Office of Neighborhood Engagement.
What was interesting was the first PCAB meeting that we went to for the 3rd District, we found out when we got to the meeting that it was rescheduled for a few days later. And so a lot of people felt as though that moment was compromising the community's ability to meet and gather and talk about things that are happening.
We see that there are definitely forums for reporting to the police exactly what you'd like to see investigated. But as far as policy level things about the way policing is done in our city, that wasn't as clear where people might go for those sorts of conversations.
I had a chance to speak with Hans Ganther, commander of the 1st District, took some of these questions to him, some of these concerns, and he talked about some of the challenges that NOPD faces themselves. This one, the challenge of the police officers to be emotionally available in a time of crisis.
You see us at your worst times most of the time. When something's traumatic happened to you, violent crime, property crime, whatever it may be. So a lot of people think the officers don't care. And we have to preserve our own sanity sometimes. And I think how we do it is to be professional about it. But sometimes when you're too professional, people consider that lack of sympathy, lack of emotion. So it's very difficult to sometimes merge the two. And I think that's where people have a problem with the police.
Officer Ganther said one other thing to me, too. We had so many requests about police walking the beats that I asked him if that's a legitimate thing. And he talked about how it would strain resources for the NOPD. Not only do they not necessarily have the numbers to make that happen, but if someone is out walking the beat, then they can't be in their car and be able to respond in a time of crisis. So it really kind of strains the force in more than one way.
It does make me wonder, though, like, when people say they want to see police walking the beat, like, what's really at the heart of that? If at the heart of that is just you want to see an officer outside of a vehicle, I wonder in what other ways that might happen that still allow an officer to be quickly able to jump in their vehicle and be dispatched.
That's a good point. Claudia, you put together a little montage for us with a whole bunch of different voices and concerns once again, didn't you?
Yes. We're going to start off our montage with a young woman who actually inspired us for this month's topic because of her interaction with NOPD.
I'm not sure if the police as an entire organization will ever have the intent to strictly serve and protect all of the people.
I was with a group of 4 of my coworkers. 2 of them were Black gay men of color, and they were driving. And they pulled us over for no apparent reason on our way back from, like, this event. It was very apparent that it was, like, profiling.
If they see you a certain way, then you don't know what to expect.
I'm of the belief if you treat the police with respect, they'll treat you with respect. If it's hot and it's summertime and they're loaded down, why don't you see if they want a glass of cold water?
I never had to call the police before. I've never had to. Except at Mardi Gras time, I see a few and I hug them. That's it.
I worked in Jefferson Parish and I had cops come into my agency to learn about what it's like to be mentally ill. I work with mentally ill clients, and I was very impressed on their emphasis of training their cops to work with people who are in crisis.
It really matters when people feel like they know the police and they feel safe and they feel like they can talk and be treated respectfully.
Well, we at the Listening Post are always open to you joining the conversation, and I will remind listeners that this month's story was inspired by a participant of our own. So we hope that you'll do the same and follow the conversation by texting the word hello to 504-303-4348. Claudia Lopez, Natalie R., thank you so much for joining me here in the studio.
Thank you.
We'll see you next month, New Orleans. Until then, remember, our microphone is your microphone.
And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre, and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's Janae at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows, and be sure to catch us next week, right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.